But in a stroke's the word. Don't take no rhythm. Don't take no style. Got a thirst for killing. Crack your mind.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is March 23rd, 2013, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Stroke Me, Stroke Me. The SGEM has not shied away from controversial emergency medicine topics. These have included emergency contraception, the Choose Wisely campaign, which ASAP wasn't thrilled about, and the dogma of wound care. But we have yet to face that elephant in the room of emergency medicine. Thrombolysis and acute ischemic stroke. Just like the elephant who carries his trunk everywhere, TPA and acute stroke also has baggage. But the purpose of the SGEM podcast is not to rehash the polar sides of this issue. The purpose of the SGEM remains to turn Med-Ed on its head using social media to get you, the SGEM listeners, the critically appraised best evidence. We want to disseminate a skeptical review of emergency medicine relevant topics while slipping in a little evidence-based medicine too. We want to try to cut that knowledge translation or KT window down from an average of 10 years to 1 year, ultimately to help you, the frontline emergency healthcare workers, provide the best care to your patients. So to quote Billy Squires, "Now everybody, have you heard? If you're in the game, then stroke's the word. Don't take no rhythm, don't take no style. Got a thirst for killing, then grab your vial." Today's case scenario is a 38-year-old woman who arrives from home with a right-sided weakness. The onset was exactly 4 hours prior to presentation to the emergency department. You diagnose her with an acute ischemic CVA with no contraindications to thrombolysis. The question is, does thrombolysis given to acute ischemic CVA in less than 6 hours increase the proportion of people who are alive and independent at 6 months? Just for a little background information to frame the discussion today, acute ischemic strokes represent the leading cause of disability in our society, and it's the third most common cause of death. There have been many studies performed looking at thrombolysis for acute CVA. For a summary of the major trials, check out David Newman's, say it with me, Newman's, Number Needed to Treat website. That's www.thennt.com. Another good review of this topic is a paper done by Chris Carpenter, or as I like to call him, Captain Cranium. Maybe I should call him Captain Cortex. Anyways, it all comes from his initials, CC, Chris Carpenter. He did an excellent review in the Journal of Emergency Medicine. When TPA was first approved, apparently, in the European Union, it was restricted to 3 hours, and the age had to be less than 80 years old. There was a Cochrane review that suggested that TPA might be of benefit for up to 6 hours. Whenever I read the word might, I always substitute might not and read it as, "A Cochrane review was suggested that TPA might not be beneficial for up to 6 hours." But I digress. Older people greater than 80 have been underrepresented in previous stroke trials. This has set the basis for the study we're going to be talking about today. It's the IST-3 trial, which stands for the Third International Stroke Trial. And it was hoping to establish the balance of benefit and harm of TPA in patients not meeting licensed criteria. In particular, they were looking at using thrombolysis in patients over the age of 80 and patients who presented after 3 hours. The official reference for today's podcast is the benefits and harms of intravenous thrombolysis with recombinant TPA within 6 hours of acute ischemic stroke, the third international stroke trial, a randomized control trial, Lancet, 2012. The population for this study was multicentered, open-label, randomized control trial with an N equal to 3,035 patients. The intervention was the standard TPA dose of 0.9 milligrams per kilogram. The control was placebo, and the outcome was alive and independent on the Oxford Handicap Scale at 6 months. Now, some of you out there may not be familiar with the Oxford Handicap Scale. Don't be alarmed, I wasn't either until I read this paper. I was more familiar with the modified Rankin Scale. Anyways, the Oxford Handicap Scale, or OHS, has 6 different levels or grades, and they range from 0 to 5. 0, 1, and 2 is considered a good outcome. A 0 means you had no deficits whatsoever. A 1 meant you had minor symptoms, but it did not interfere with your lifestyle at all. And a 2, or a grade 2, was a minor handicap with some restrictions, but you're still able to look after yourself. And then everything else that was a grade 3, 4, or 5 had moderate to severe handicap. The results of the IST3 trial were as follows. There was a total, like I said, of 3,035 patients. There was 1,515 in the treatment group with TPA, and 1,520 patients in the control group. 95% did not meet the European Union licensed approved criteria, and over half, 53%, were greater than 80 years old. The mean time to receive TPA was 4.2 hours. So let's look at the primary outcome. The primary outcome for this trial was, again, live and independent of activities on a daily living score, the Oxford Handicap score, ranging from grade 0 to 2. In other words, no problem with their lifestyle, up to some minor restrictions, but you're still able to take care of yourself. And what was the primary outcome result? That was my drum roll. No difference. That's right. Absolutely no difference. There was 37% in the TPA group versus 35% in the control group that had an OHS grade of 0 to 2. Now, the adjusted odds ratio was 1.13 with a very narrow confidence interval. The 95% confidence interval was very narrow. And whenever I say that, I hold my hands up close. They're narrow. It was 0.95 to 1.35. And that's the way I look at odds ratios. If they're narrow, my hands are close together and I'm sure of this. And you know, if I've got my arms really wide going, I don't know, that's a wide confidence interval. So in this case, the primary outcome, no difference, narrow confidence interval, and no difference with the adjusted odds ratio, 1.13 with the confidence interval overlapping 1. No difference in the primary outcome. Well, how about harm? We're always worried about harm, and they did specify some harm with regards to this trial. The first harm was dead within 7 days. There was a difference, 11% in the TPA group versus 7% in the control group, i.e. a 4% increase in death within the first 7 days. The adjusted odds ratio was 1.6, and the confidence interval was 1.22 to 2.08. In other words, there was a significant increase in death at 7 days, a 4% absolute increase, or a number needed to harm of 25. There was also fatal or non-fatal intracranial hemorrhage. So fatal or non-fatal ICH went up significantly. It was 7% in the TPA group and 1% in the control group. Go figure, you give someone a blood thinner, they're more likely to bleed. So 7% in the TPA group versus 1% in the control group, or a 6% increase. and that had an adjusted odds ratio of 6.94 with a confidence interval ranging from 4.07 up to 11.8. When they looked at death at 6 months, though, there was no difference. 27% of the people died receiving TPA, and 27% of people died if they were in the control group. There was a secondary outcome that they also reported, which I think merits us going through. They reported a significant difference in ordinal shift. The ordinal shift was between the grade scales of the OHS, or the Oxford Handicap Scale. Now, I told you previously that the Oxford Handicap Scale actually went from 0 to 5. It can give you a grading of 6, which is death. And that's important when we talk about the secondary outcome. So they reported a significant difference in the ordinal shift between grades. The common odds ratio was 1.27 with a confidence interval of 1.1 to 1.47. Before they started the study, they a priori, or before the study, calculated that they would need 6,000 patients to detect an absolute difference of 10% in the proportion of patients alive and independent at 6 months and have the power to do all their subgroup analysis. Now, they said that they had the power with 6,000 patients to detect, quote, clinically worthwhile, end of quote, net benefit. And with that number of 6,000, they would even be able to go down to a 3% absolute difference and pick those up. They would have 80% power to do that with an alpha of 0.05. And if you remember, an alpha is a type 1 error, and a type 1 error is incorrectly rejecting the null hypothesis. But here is in the paper where they come out with a big but, a big B-U-T. The but they came out with was the following. By 2007, they realized that they could not get 6,000 patients. They couldn't enroll 6,000 patients so that they would have the power to detect as little as 3%, but at least a 10% difference with all their subgroup analysis. They realized they wouldn't have the numbers. So the steering committee got together and they agreed to a revised recruitment strategy. Can you say moving the goalposts? They came up with the fact that if they decreased the N to 3,000, so if they only had 3,000 patients, then they would be able to detect a 4.7% difference in the primary outcome. And remember, they were looking with 6,000 to be able to detect as small as 3% difference. But if they had only 3,000 patients, then they could detect a 4.7% difference. So the difference would have to be bigger. So they got another statistician in who was reported as independent to advise them on what to do. And the writing group was, quote, persuaded, end of quote, that the ordinal method that they were going to use was both statistically more efficient. In other words, they could reduce the sample size from 6,000 to 3,000 in the trial, and that it would be robust enough against substantial deviations from the proportional assumption. So they did this secondary analysis. So they combined level 4, 5, and 6 into one group, and they kept the lower levels or lower grades of the Oxford Handicap Scale independent at 0, 1, 2, and 3. So they had 0, 1, 2, and 3 as distinct groups, and then they had level 4, 5, and 6 combined into just one group. That left over only 5 levels instead of the original 7 levels for the OHS. And I'm sorry if I'm confusing everybody, but this is important. They did an ordinal logistic regression analysis, and they made the assumption that the odds ratio between each level or each grade were constant. Now, the reason I said I didn't want to confuse all of you is because I'm confused. I mean, I'm not a statistician, okay? But all of this mental statistical gymnastics just makes me think something is starting to smell. To raise the level of this podcast up, I'd have to quote the bard and say, "Methink he doth protest too much." It just doesn't pass the whiff test, does it? Anyways, to summarize their results, their primary outcome was no difference. The harm was there was more people died in the first 7 days, a 4% absolute increase, and there was a 6% absolute increase in death, or sorry, in fatal and non-fatal ICH, and death at 6 months showed no difference. And they had a significantly different secondary outcome in ordinal shifts on the grade scale of the Oxford Handicap Scale. So what did the authors conclude from all this? Get ready for it. Quote, for the types of patients recruited in the IST-3, despite the early hazards, thrombolysis within 6 hours improved functional outcome. Benefit did not seem to be diminished in elderly patients. End of quote. The Beam comments on this article was that it was a pragmatic, multi-centered, randomized control, open-label trial. It did seek to define if older patients and patients treated in less than 6 hours with acute CVA onset would benefit from TPA. The trial did not meet its target of 6,000 patients. The outcome of patients greater than 80 years old were no different than those of younger patients. Also, patients treated with TPA greater than 3 hours showed no significant benefit over those treated with placebo. There were a number of limitations to the IST-3 study, and I think it represents an excellent opportunity to discuss a number of evidence-based medicine issues. The first thing is that this was a pragmatic trial. Some of you may not be familiar with pragmatic trials. Pragmatic trials are a relatively new phenomenon. They try to do trials in more of a real-life setting. Now, this offers some advantages because you can expand it to the real-world situation as opposed to the very controlled setting of a typical randomized clinical control trial. But from an evidence-based medicine standpoint, it does make it a bit messier, and we like to control certain things, in particular bias. So there are some limitations to doing pragmatic trials. As my EBM guru always says, Dr. Andrew Worster, it depends what question you're trying to answer. Another limitation to this is that it was an open-label trial, and there was no allocation concealment. In other words, people knew what they were getting. Now, the authors do talk about how they blinded the individuals, and the individual researchers is what I'm talking about, with regards to outcome. But the patients weren't blinded. So if the patients knew that they were getting this fancy schmancy, very expensive, very powerful drug, do you think that when they were called up at 6 months and said, so, subjectively, how are you doing? How are your activities of daily living? There might be, I would suggest, a bias to report something good. Something, I am doing better. And so the lack of blinding with regards to allocation concealment and it being an open label trial does create some problems. In addition, patients that were included in the trial were ones that the doctor and patients were thought to benefit from the treatment. So there already was a bias going into this. Even before they did the allocation and concealment, you could only get into the trial if the doctor and the patient or their family members thought that they would be of benefit. Another limitation is that they missed their target by 50%. They were supposed to have 6,000 patients in this trial and only ended up getting 3,000 patients. And then after 7 years, they seem to have moved the goalposts. To do this, they brought in another statistician, and he persuaded them on a different way to analyze the data. Another limitation was that the primary outcome showed no difference. Now, I don't have a problem with a trial showing no difference. What I do have, though, is a problem with a trial showing no difference and then it being reported as a positive trial. And remember, there were big harms in this trial. The death rate went up, and the bleeding rate went up, both significantly. Reading studies like this turned me into more of a skeptic. I mean, really, this was published in The Lancet. The Lancet. Now I'm going to have to read The Lancet much more carefully. So the Beam bottom line, treatment with TPA in this study harmed i.e. death, 1 in 25 patients early. The fatal and non-fatal bleed rate went up significantly, and there was no benefit seen at 6 months in the primary outcome. The case resolution for today's podcast is that you discuss the options of using TPA with the patient and their family members. Given her age is 83 and the time now being over 4.5 hours, you reach a shared decision point not to use thrombolysis. Okay, the Keener contest from last week, the winner was Sam Brewer, a PGY4. He correctly identified that metoclopramide, Maxaran or Reglan, can cause extrapyramidal side effects like dystonia or tardive dyskinesia. And the treatment for this feared reaction is diphenhydramine, or Benadryl, or benztropine, Cogentin. This week's Keener contest is related to thrombolysis and stroke. It has been now almost 20 years since the original NINS trial came out. So the Keener contest for this week is I want you to go back into the literature and find out how many patients were actually treated with TPA in the original NINS trial, and what was the absolute benefit, and what was the absolute harm. So I'm looking for the number of patients treated with TPA in the 1995 article, New England Journal of Medicine. What was the actual number treated, and what was the absolute harm, and the absolute benefit. Be the first person to email me back with the correct answer, thesgem@gmail.com, and use Keener Contest in the subject line, and I will mail you a very, very cool skeptical prize. Remember, everyone, to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Talk with you next week. Yeah.